Anybody wants to trust the legislature and give up all their cards in the expectation that they'll do something later is just not very realistic.
Criticism of a plan that could make the permanent fund less permanent. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, May 17th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the problem of marine debris.
This is a shoreline where 30 tons of plastic debris per mile exists, but extremely rugged. The weather is horrible.
Sorry, did I hear that right?
Say 30 tons of plastic debris per mile.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's tobacco quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
Alaska's government has never in 40 years used permanent fund earnings to balance the state budget. That could change this year. How the legislature and Governor Bill Walker handle a plan could have big implications on Alaska's permanent fund dividends. Andrew Kitchenman of APRN and KTOO in Juneau reports.
Wednesday is the last day of the legislative session, and lawmakers head into it without knowing how they're going to fill a roughly $3.5 billion deficit. Majority legislative leaders would prefer to close this shortfall by spending money from the Constitutional Budget Reserve. This nearly $8 billion reserve has been used to close deficits in previous years. But three-quarters of both legislative chambers must approve a Constitutional Budget Reserve draw. The Senate majority could pass it, but members of the Democratic-led House Minority Caucus are in position to block this draw. They want to make deep cuts in tax credits to oil and gas producers. So legislative leaders, like Senate President Kevin Meyer, are considering drawing money from the Permanent Fund Earnings Reserve account.
Well, the CBR draw is our preference, of course, and we will have the three-quarter vote here to do that, and that will be our recommendation. If that doesn't happen, then our only option then is to then use the earning reserve account in some capacity. So that will pretty much be up to the House.
Meyer says the legislature could pass the budget tomorrow and then return for a special session that would focus in part on making long-term changes to a fiscal plan for using permanent fund earnings, similar to what Governor Walker has called for. Different proposals to restructure fund earnings could lead to cuts to permanent fund dividends, possibly cutting them in half. The permanent fund is made up of two pieces. The main body of the fund is $43 billion. It's protected by the state constitution. That's what makes it permanent. The other piece is the earnings reserve account. It's about $7.5 billion. Normally, these earnings are just used for dividends and to replenish the main fund. But the earnings reserve is also easier for the legislature to spend than the constitutional budget reserve. It only takes a majority of both legislative bodies to spend this money. This could happen tomorrow. The prospect is drawing the attention of longtime observers of Alaska's budget process. Oregon-based economist Greg Erickson is the former publisher of the Alaska Budget Report.
We know that if you take money from the earnings reserve, it's going to reduce the dividend, and that, in a sense, puts the burden of this financing on the people of Alaska who are least able to pay for it.
Erickson says it would be foolish for Walker to agree to a deep draw from the earnings reserve if he's not certain what the legislature would do in a special session.
Anybody wants to trust the legislature and give up all their cards, basically, in the expectation that they'll do something later, particularly when it's so vague, is just not very realistic.
This point is reinforced by political scientist Clive Thomas. His book, Alaska Politics and Public Policy, is being published next month. Thomas says legislators may be hoping that oil prices will increase. He added that Governor Walker's budget plan included both a reduction in permanent fund dividends, which affects lower income and rural Alaskans the most, and an income tax, which would affect upper income residents more heavily. The legislature hasn't passed the income tax. Thomas says lawmakers would like to put off politically difficult choices in an election year.
The state is in a bad situation, and you've got to do something about it. And it's going to mean, in some ways or another, a reduction in Alaska's lifestyle and the quality of life. I think that's just inevitable, but no politician will say that to anybody.
Institute of Social and Economic Research Director Gunnar Knapp says however the legislature and governor spend from the state savings, it will have significant implications for the future.
There's all the difference in the world between doing that in a structured, thoughtful way and simply saying, here's a pot of money we can go to make up for the spending that we're not willing to cut and we're not willing to tax ourselves to pay for.
The legislature is preparing to pass both the capital and operating budgets on Wednesday. Walker has said he can't accept the budget with a permanent fund draw without having a sustainable fiscal plan. A spokeswoman for Walker says he'll decide after the session ends if there's a need for a special session. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
An oil-dependent economy straddling the Arctic Circle, battered by low oil prices, but sitting on a massive savings account. That could describe Alaska, but it also describes Norway. Norway's ambassador to the United States is in Alaska this week to celebrate that country's May 17th Constitution Day with Norwegian Americans in Anchorage and Petersburg. But he couldn't avoid questions about how his country is handling low oil prices and what Alaska might learn from Norway's example. From the Energy Desk, APRN's Rachel Waldholz reports.
It might be a rite of passage for foreign dignitaries visiting Alaska these days, being asked for advice on the state's $4 billion budget hole. This time it was Lisa Falsko of the Alaska World Affairs Council who posed the question to the Norwegian ambassador at the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce.
Do you have any thoughts on that or recommendations on?
I don't.
But Ambassador Corey Ose said he could talk about what's happening in Norway, where, for the record, nobody is freaking out. Because while Alaska and Norway have plenty in common, including a northern location, economies built around oil and gas, and massive savings accounts, there are also some major differences. For starters, Norway's economy is far more diversified, Ose said.
The maritime sector is very, very important to Norway. The same is the fisheries, fish farming. I shouldn't perhaps say that here.
Ose also mentioned IT and tourism. In all, he estimates Norway only gets about 20% of government revenue from oil and gas. That's compared to nearly 90% of unrestricted state spending in Alaska just a few years ago. And while Norway founded its sovereign wealth fund some two decades after Alaska did, its fund has grown to more than $850 billion. Alaska's permanent fund has about $53 billion. Ose says there is broad consensus that Norway's fund must be saved for the future.
The basic idea that this is for the next generation and the generations after that is so solid, and it's so sort of part of, I would say, the Norwegian society.
The Norwegian government can use a percentage of the fund's value to cover budget needs, though this year it marked the first time ever that it exercised that right. That design is similar to a proposal before the Alaska legislature to use a portion of permanent fund earnings to fund state government. Another key difference? Norway never got rid of its taxes, a point raised by a member of the Anchorage audience who asked if Norway still has an income tax. Oh yes, Ose said.
We have income tax and we have sales tax of 25%. We have probably the highest gasoline prices in the world. And we have income tax and we will always have income tax.
One result of all these differences, Ose said, is that unlike Alaska, where lawmakers are struggling to cut state spending, Norway's government has expanded spending in the face of low oil prices to try to stimulate the economy and soften the impacts of job losses in oil-dependent regions. From the Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholz in Anchorage.
U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan chaired a hearing in Washington this morning on marine debris, and he asked the panel of experts he assembled if there was consensus on what the focus should be.
Is everybody in general agreement on that? Plastics.
Saying it, Sullivan said he felt like he was in that 1960s movie, The Graduate, where a young man is advised to take a promising career path.
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
plastics.
But rather than a symbol of our country's bright future, plastics at this hearing played the role of villain. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
The top Democrat on the Environment Subcommittee Sullivan chairs, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, showed photos of dead seabirds with bellies full of plastic lighters and other trash. Whitehouse of Rhode Island did a double take as Chris Pallister of Gulf of Alaska Keeper described the enormity of his group's task on one location, Montague Island.
We have 10 people out there working. We have to move them with helicopters, so you can imagine the cost. And this is a shoreline where 30 tons of plastic debris per mile exists, but extremely rugged. The weather is horrible.
Sorry, did I hear that right?
Say that again. 30 tons of plastic debris per mile.
Whoa.
We've been working on, Montague has 74 miles of shoreline just like that. And we've been working on it for 3 summers now, and we've only cleaned 9 miles of it.
Not to mention the other thousands of miles of Alaska coast. And Pallister says there's no steady funding for cleanup work. He says he's particularly worried about what happens to plastic as it fragments in the ocean. And Whitehouse zeroed in on the impact.
Chemicals like phthalates that are put in the plastic to make it soft or pliable or stuff, they aren't very strongly bonded to the plastic, and they leach out very equally or easily. And
so this could come home to roost in Alaskan salmon or...
Oh, absolutely.
Other witnesses said 5 developing countries are responsible for more than half of the world's plastic ocean debris: China, Indonesia, the Philippines, Vietnam, and Sri Lanka. Sullivan says he's looking for ways the U.S. can work with other countries to stem the flow of land-based trash washing into the ocean. Pallister says the government should also hold shippers financially responsible for containers they lose at sea, which he says will continue to pollute for generations. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, tragic drowning deaths in Marshall.
She was my mom's friend, and when my mother passed away, she became a mother figure for me.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Commercial, sport, subsistence, personal use. Some hear these labels and think conflict. The Salmon Project sees connections. Join 10,000 Alaskans whose lives are connected by Alaska's salmon. Visit salmonlife.org to experience the stories. And find the Salmon Project on Facebook to join the community. Salmon Life, Salmon Love. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
2 elders drown over the weekend in Marshall when their vehicle suddenly slid into the Yukon River. The couple left a legacy of sharing traditional knowledge with their community. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
According to the Alaska State Trooper Dispatch, Angelina Coffey, age 76, and her husband Frank Coffey, age 80, were launching their boat Saturday evening. Frank was driving when the vehicle suddenly plunged down a steep bank into the water. A nearby man dove into the river to pull out the couple. Bystanders began administering CPR and transported the elders to the community clinic. The couple was pronounced dead about an hour after the accident. Clara Shorty was in the clinic lobby praying with the Coffey family when the pronouncement came. Afterwards, she blessed the bodies with holy water. Clara worked with Angelina at the Marshall Catholic Church for more than 20 years and says the couple stood as respected elders among the community.
They both contribute to our community by sharing our native way of life. They show their children and grandchildren how to gather up the land, how to prepare and preserve fish for the winter, how to hunt off the land.
Clara says Angelina also instructed students at the Marshall School, telling traditional stories and teaching skills like crocheting and fur boot making. Clara says the elder mentored everyone.
She was my mom's friend, and when my mother passed away, she became a mother figure for me. She was my elder. If I had puzzling questions about life problems, I would go to her and she would give me advice.
Clara and Angelina served as Eucharistic ministers at the church and would hold services and funerals with the women's close relationship. Clara says she won't be able to lead the Coffey's funeral. The emotion would be too great. She says the Sunday service, the morning after the accident, was the hardest she ever did.
Because knowing her, that she won't be with me anymore during the services was a little hard, but I made it through. Family members were there, and that made me happy too, made me be able to go through the service.
Angelina worked as the school cook until retirement. Frank hunted, trapped, and worked as a mechanic. They are survived by 8 children and many grandchildren. The family will decide the funeral date once the bodies return from the state medical examiner's office in Anchorage. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
An Anchorage man was mauled by a brown bear near Yakutat over the weekend. 29-year-old Kenneth Steck was medevaced to Providence Medical Center in Anchorage on Friday after suffering extensive bite wounds. It's the second serious mauling in southeast Alaska this season. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
According to Yakutat police, Steck went camping in Disenchantment Bay on Thursday near Callahonda Creek with his wife and several other friends. The group was armed and planning to hunt for black bear if they saw any. On Friday, Steck left camp on his own to get water from the creek when he was attacked by a large brown bear. Although he had a weapon, he was unable to draw it in time to use it. According to police, the attack may have lasted up to 2 minutes before others from Steck's party arrived to drive off the animal. Steck reportedly suffered severe wounds to his lower leg, scalp, and shoulder. He received first aid from his wife, Hannah, an RN, and 2 other RNs in the party. Their call to the Coast Guard was overheard by the Yakutat Police Department. Officer Jeff Lee reported to the Yakutat Clinic to collect additional medical supplies. Lee and clinic staffer Mark Schultz traveled aboard the Yakutat Harbormaster boat and met the campers in Johnstone Passage and began administering advanced medical care. Steck was stabilized at the Yakutat Clinic and medevaced to Providence and Anchorage. Hospital officials confirm that he has since been released. Officer Lee says the attack appears to have been unprovoked. The bear is presumed to be a boar rather than a female with cubs. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game has been doing DNA studies in the area. The department will attempt to collect DNA samples from the victim's clothing, but Lee says the biologist he's spoken with thinks it's unlikely that they'll be able to identify the bear responsible for the attack. This is the second mauling in Southeast so far this spring. On April 18th, the UAS outdoor instructor, Forrest Wagner, was seriously mauled in Haines while teaching a class. He was hospitalized for about 3 weeks. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
A remote southeast community was the scene of an alleged homicide on Sunday. KHNS's Jillian Rogers has the details.
Juneau's Mark DeSimone is charged with first and second degree murder in the shooting of 34-year-old Dulio Tony Rosales in Excursion Inlet. Rosales is also from Juneau. DeSimone is also charged with manslaughter and criminally negligent homicide. Juneau Assistant District Attorney Amy Page said Tuesday afternoon charging a variety of offenses is not uncommon in a case like this.
The state will charge every theory of an offense that the facts might warrant in order that we can present that to a grand jury for them to make a determination about what specific charges the evidence supports.
According to charging documents, a call went out to troopers from the U.S. Coast Guard around 7:30 Sunday evening, reporting that someone had been shot in the head in Excursion Inlet. Excursion Inlet is a secluded community 40 miles west of Juneau in the Haynesboro with a year-round population of less than a dozen. When Trooper Ryan Anderson arrived by plane a couple of hours later, he saw 6 men on the beach in front of a cabin. According to court documents, one man handed him a .41 caliber Magnum revolver and stated that it was likely the weapon used in the shooting. Trooper's spokesperson Tim Despain said that while there was a group in the area on a hunting trip, it is not believed that either man involved in the shooting was part of that hunting group. Trooper Anderson located Rosales lying in a pool of blood under a picnic table with what appeared to be 2 gunshot wounds to the back of the head. The charging documents went on and said that Rosales appeared to have been sitting on a picnic table removing his boots when he was shot and then rolled onto the ground. The trooper noted that Rosales was wearing an empty holster on his hip. A witness told Anderson he ran into DeSimone shortly after he heard gunshots, and DeSimone told him, quote, "I shot Tony. I shot him. It's my fault," end quote. A preliminary hearing is scheduled for May 27th in Juneau Superior Court. Rosales' next of kin have been notified. An online fundraising page states that Rosales is married with two children. It says that Rosales, originally from Nicaragua, came to Alaska in 2011 and worked at a jewelry store in Juneau. Reporting in Haines, I'm Jillian Rogers.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Alaska Republican leaders from all parts of the GOP spectrum are uniting behind Donald Trump for president. The Trump campaign's Alaska branch yesterday released a list of honorary co-chairs. It includes legislators Mike Chenault and Liesl McGuire, as well as former Lieutenant Governor Lauren Lehman. Anchorage Baptist Temple pastor Jerry Prevost and conservative talk radio host Glenn Beagle are on the list, as is former Alaska Commerce Commissioner Paul Fuse. Some of the two dozen Alaska co-chairs previously supported Trump's Republican rivals. State campaign chairman Jim Crawford says they understand the importance of Republican solidarity in winning the White House. Not on the list of Trump co-chairs, any member of Alaska's congressional delegation. The state Trump campaign also announced its platform committee, which it says will help shape Trump's Alaska policy. It includes former Lieutenant Governor Meade Treadwell, former State Senate President Drew Pierce, and former Anchorage Mayor Rick Maestrom. In order to fight rising property crime, Anchorage needs more police. That's the conclusion of a group of young experts, a class of eighth graders in Anchorage. And as Alaska Public Media's Zechariah Hughes reports, they think they've got a solution for city leaders.
Okay, I need everyone's attention right up here. Who would like to, which group would like to share?
It's a beautiful, sunny day at Gruning Middle School, just a week before summer break, and Ms. Tanya Shakov's social studies class is talking about crime.
Some of you said, well, we can never stop crime altogether. Was that our goal?
No.
What was our goal then?
To reduce it.
Okay, good. To reduce the numbers.
The class is wrapping up something called Project Citizen, a three-month-long education program that tries to engage kids in the civic process for fixing community problems. Today, the class is recapping what worked. Initially, they considered focusing on education funding or maybe school lunches. But when students started doing interviews with parents and teachers about problems facing the municipality, they heard a lot of concerns over rising crime rates. So they began researching.
All right, Tyler.
We also had to like write down every website and look at it to see if there's any good information because we had like a bunch.
Tyler Ormsby is sitting with his class partner Matthew Rainey, and the two tell me where they got their statistics.
When she said you guys looked at websites, what kind of websites were you looking at?
Neighborhood Watch, also Neighborhood Scout.
I used the FBI crime rates. And I also use the most dangerous countries in America, USA Today.
Gruning Middle School is in Eagle River, a corner of the municipality that has long enjoyed a reputation as a neighborly, semi-rural suburb, free of big city problems like high crime rates. But that's changing. The area's assembly representatives held a public forum earlier this month focused on a perception that drug use and property crime are on the rise.
And I was talking to my mom, like, I don't think crime's that big of an issue. And she's like, oh, yeah, it is.
and I realized crime is a really, really big issue.
Gabby Schilling explains that around the time the class started researching, there was an incident at the daycare where she volunteers that put the topic front and center for her. A teacher's car was broken into in the parking lot, and some college textbooks were taken. Schilling says seeing how disruptive and unnerving the theft was for someone she actually knew added a human face to all the statistics she was seeing in the classroom.
Sometimes when you're looking at statistics, you normally just see, oh, that's 84. Cool, it's a number. But when we were actually looking at crime, we realized that these statistics, one of those persons, like the stories behind them were amazing. Like it's just really personal when you realize that they're individual people instead of numbers.
According to data from the police department, crime in Eagle River isn't rising. In fact, by a lot of measures, it's actually nudging downward. But that's not what these students perceive. And their solution is to hire more police, a view shared not only by the police department itself, but the mayor's administration, too. So the students started a media campaign, writing letters to policymakers and news organizations, which is how I came across a letter in my mailbox at work, signed by one Gabby Schilling, politely asking for help raising awareness about police staffing levels.
If I was in that job, I would be terrified because I have to do all this work, and I'm saving people's lives, potentially, if I were in that job. And so it was just kind of crazy with the statistics she gave us.
This is the fifth year Ms. Shakov has run Project Citizen, and she's used to classes picking topics like substance abuse, suicide, and crime that are grim but keep students invested. Her priority, though, is getting young people engaged in the civic process itself.
Year after year, when kids come back and visit me at school, they ask, are you still doing Project Citizen? Because that's the piece that light bulb went on. I have a voice. I don't have to be an adult to make change in my community. I can start even at my age.
Project Citizen culminates in a contest in front of judges where this class got eighth place. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found on our website, alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Rachel Waldholtz and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Jillian Rogers in Haines. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaskans and Alaska's communities and in operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
The Business Administration Program at Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive education grounded in real-world experience with life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. Move forward with APU and apply today at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU. What can a tiny piece of dust do to you? It can stop you in your tracks. Studies show exposure to dust pollution can cause tightness in your chest, wheezing, and shortness of breath, even if you're healthy. When you're on an unpaved road, drive slowly, especially when operating an ATV. When hauling dirt, cover it up. Do your part, avoid dust, and clear the air. We'll all breathe easier. This message sponsored by Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.